This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Hello, this is Jeanette Lefebvre, your guest host tonight on the People Speak Radio, filling in for Bassema Farhat. At the People Speak, we believe that the voices and actions of ordinary people make a difference. You can listen to the People Speak at bbsradio.com, live every Tuesday night from 8:55 to 9:55 p.m. Eastern Time. You can also log into our website at thepeoplespeakradio.com to listen to us live, join us through our live chat on Paltalk, or listen to the archives of previous shows. We broadcast 1 hour live to the USA, the United Kingdom, Canada, and Australia. If you have guests for our guests, you can call, or if you have questions for our guests, you can call 415-762-1160 or 712-432-0075, access number 318-116. You can also listen and call via your smartphone, so you never have to miss the best guest on Internet radio. Tonight, I am here with Mr. Kevin Annett. Mr. Annett graduated from the University of British Columbia with a bachelor's degree in anthropology and a master's degree in political science. In 1990, he graduated from the Vancouver School of Theology with a master's of divinity and was subsequently ordained by the British of Columbia Conference of the United Church of Canada. He's here tonight to speak with us on the subject of the abuses and deaths in the Canadian residential schools for Native Canadian children. Mr. Annett has written two books on the subject of the residential school abuse in Canada. The first, Hidden from History, The Canadian Holocaust, was published first in 2001. The second, Love and Death in the Valley, was published in 2002. In 2006, Kevin produced a documentary on the topic, Unrepentant, Kevin Annett and Canada's Genocide, which won the 2006 award for Best Director at the New York International Independent Film and Video Festival. Now, thank you for being here with us tonight, Kevin. I prefer to let the... I've filled in a little bit of the background here. There's a lot of updates on what I've just covered there in reference to your organization, filing against Stephen Harper and the government of Canada. How about if I just let you tell us what you're doing and why you're doing it and how far you have gotten?
Okay, thank you. First of all, I'm sorry for coming on late. We had some car trouble down the road, so I apologize. In a nutshell, I guess you could say that this has been a 15-year campaign that I've been involved with, starting out as a clergyman on the west coast of Canada, but now really it's an international movement to hold the churches and governments responsible for this genocide, holding them responsible and also trying to bring them to justice. Right now, the situation is that I'm actually part of a tribunal based in London, England, where I'll be going next week, and we have actually served subpoenas on the Pope, various senior cardinals, and government officials, including Stephen Harper, the Prime Minister of Canada. The reason we've done that is because eyewitness evidence, documentation, and now even forensic evidence from various grave sites across Canada indicates that more than 50,000 children died in these Indian boarding schools over a century, and that this was not the result of a random death, but rather a deliberate policy of exterminating Native people under the guise of education and religion. So this is a really serious crime. It's really crimes against humanity happening right here in North America. And the effects are ongoing, of course, in the Aboriginal world. So this is something that has become something much bigger than what I originally encountered when I 15 years ago as a minister in Port Alberni.
Now, what brought your attention to the abuses? I'm familiar with the fact that this has happened in Canada. This has been a part of the history that the Canadian government made an apology a few years back. and offered a financial settlement to the victims of the residential school.
Well, that's kind of the official story. The reality is less than about 20% or less of survivors have ever received a cent in compensation. And those who have received money have been forced to sign an indemnification whereby they never sue the church as responsible and they never hold any of them accountable under the law for what occurred. The government also has made it clear that they don't intend to press criminal charges against these churches because, in effect, they were collaborating with them when they were running these boarding schools. It was a joint government and church operation. So like in Ireland and other countries, the guilty parties here have pretty much indemnified themselves and avoided any criminal prosecution while dropping a few crumbs of compensation and apology to those who did survive the system. So it's completely inadequate, and in fact, it's also a violation of international standards, human rights conventions, which Canada is a party to. This is why we're not relying on Canada to prosecute itself for this, but rather we're taking it to international bodies, including the International Criminal Court in Europe, eventually. So, working on the ground like I do with a lot of the survivors of these crimes, you see that the official account is one thing; the reality is very different on the ground.
Okay. Now, as something else I've run across during the research I was doing for this show, is that you were recently attacked. Your radio show was canceled. That there seems to be a concerted effort at this point in time to stop you from speaking. Would you care to address this for my audience?
Well, it's really an ongoing thing. As far back as 1998, when I helped organize the first inquiry into this in Vancouver, I've faced those kinds of attacks. But it definitely has intensified in the last little while. For example, I should tell the listeners that you can follow a lot of this work on our website, www.hiddenfromhistory.org. But there's a second site we've recently posted containing all of my research, and that's hiddennolonger.com. And the reason we posted my research up there in the last month or so is all of the books that containing this research were beginning to disappear from university libraries across Canada. So far, 8 libraries, our book has gone missing, our book Hidden from History, the Canadian Holocaust. So we realized that the way to, get around that is simply to post it now, and people can read for themselves the hard evidence of this genocide. So there's that kind of overt censorship that's been going on. There's at Vancouver Co-op Radio, where I did a program for almost 10 years. In August, I was unilaterally banned from the airwaves and from the station right after we had aired a program where 2 Native women were eyewitnesses to the fact that the Royal Canadian Mounted Police appear to be involved, at least elements within the RCMP appear to be involved with the actual disappearance and murder of Native women on the West Coast. They were seen at the farm of this serial killer, Willie Picton, who's now in jail. And these women were identifying individual Mounties who were apparently involved with Picton. Well, as soon as we aired that, I was simply banned, as were 3 other programmers from Co-op Radio who had been given voice to that same story. So clearly I would say that there's an attempt now that we've taken the story outside Canada and it's getting a lot more publicity, there's definitely an attempt to shut down the whole thing and to really censor us completely.
Okay, now you were banned by the radio station, not the government, correct?
Well, the government funds the station and monitors it. It's half their revenue comes from the federal government. And the Canadian Radio and Television Commission, which is a government-run operation, they monitor every program. So it's not a private operation at all. It's definitely influenced by the government.
Okay, I see. Now, you've been active in this for 20 years. How did you get involved? Are you working with a particular nation of the Canadian Indigenous, or do you work with all the groups? Are you actively affiliated with the councils of these various nations?
Well, the people I work with, by and large, are most of the Native people in Canada live off reserve. They live in the cities, and they don't have a lot of access to government money or resources. A lot of the people who comprise our film and the stories in our books and the other research are urban Aboriginal people who aren't really affiliated with any traditional tribal council or anything like that. Those are by and large the people I work with. There have been Native chiefs who've come along and endorsed what we're doing, but the reality in Canada is that a lot of these Native groups are government-funded, and they were told very clearly from the beginning that this is not an issue they would be really allowed to be involved with. I've had chiefs tell me that they've been threatened with the loss of their government funding if they start raising issues as we have, like the children who died in these residential schools and were buried in unmarked graves. So you could say that there is a kind of a division in the Native world between the government-funded Native organizations and those that aren't, and it's the latter that I tend to work with. If you just look at our films and books, you'll see that most of the people who are speaking out tend to be poor Aboriginal people who are really the descendants of those in the residential schools who were, targeted for these crimes.
Okay, now, my understanding is the residential schools were closed in the 1970s?
They began to be closed in the 70s, but the last one in Canada didn't close till 1996, actually. And even though they closed, a lot of if you look at the number of Native children being put in white foster homes and losing contact with their family and their language and culture, it's still continuing at a very high rate. So you could say that the effects, you know, in the Native world are very much continuing, even though formally the schools closed 10 to 20 years ago.
Well, I live in the USA, and I'm of Indigenous descent, and I've had friends that have been in the residential schools here in the USA. The stories aren't quite as horrific as some of what I've heard coming out of Canada, but, again, that was local to me. So the people that you work with, what are they seeking from Canada? What is it that they want to accomplish?
Well, you know, so many of them are struggling to survive that the question really isn't, for them, that isn't the question. The question is, how are they going to be able to survive the impact of all these things? And a lot of them aren't. I mean, the death rate among the people I work with is 20 to 30 times the national average. It's not unusual for me to do a funeral of a man in his 40s who died of diabetes or through a drug overdose or any number of other things. But what you often hear in the healing circles that I work in is people saying, first of all, I want my story to be heard, I want to be taken seriously, and I want the people who did this to somehow be brought to trial because, I've never gotten my day in court, in other words. And those are the very things that are being denied people because under this deal worked out between the churches and the government and some of the government-funded Native groups, people have been told, okay, you can get $10,000, and then you sign off, and that's it. And there's a gag order put on people after that where they can't even tell their story anymore. So it's really not the government isn't going to the survivors themselves and asking them what they want. They're just telling them again that this is what's good for them, and they're better take it or leave it. There's a lot of frustration on the ground that are people facing after all of this so-called healing and reconciliation process. It really hasn't changed their life very much.
And I understand that with the kind of damage that was done, that $10,000 is a drop in the bucket compared to the cost of treatment for the various psychological damage done that endured for a lifetime.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, when you look at even at the level of, if you want to talk about the monetary settlements, in the United States, when the Catholic Church began settling with some of their, the white kids, non-natives who were abused by priests, the settlements are usually in the millions of dollars. But in Canada, they were told the maximum you can get is $10,000 if you can prove you went to a school. You know, some of the settlements have been higher, but the reality is that money doesn't really solve a lot of the problems people are facing. And as a minimum, the churches should at least be picking up the medical bills and the counseling costs and everything for people whose lives have been ruined by church employees. So, yeah, definitely it's what's happened so far is really as terrible as the original crime itself, and it certainly isn't getting any better.
Okay, now, the organization that has subpoenaed them, the International Council for Crimes of Church and State, what are their professional affiliation? I was not able to find a lot of background information. Could you?
There's actually a website now. It's itccs.org, International Tribunal into Crimes of Church and State. And it's being established by groups in five countries. These are all groups for now that are survivors of the Catholic Church, groups in Australia, Ireland, England, the U.S., and Canada. And from those groups, there's several lawyers, including a native lawyer in the U.S., who've come forward to offer their services. There's also been a promise of support from the politicians in Italy and in Ireland who are actually trying to get the European Union to endorse this tribunal and see charges brought against the various parties and individuals who are responsible for this. So it's still in the formative stages. The opening session is slated for September 12th in London. And what the hope is that it'll generate other actions by governments and others that have the power to bring formal charges. Like, don't forget that under the International Criminal Court Convention, rape and child trafficking are now considered crimes against humanity. And certainly the Pope and these government and church leaders around the world are guilty of these crimes against humanity. The question now is there the political will to prosecute when, you know, clearly these crimes are continuing. They're not something that happened, 20 or 50 or 100 years ago.
So this includes all the victims. ITCCS covers victims primarily of the Catholic Church. And in any of
well, it's begun that way for now. Like, don't forget, most of the Indian boarding schools in Canada were run by the Catholics. There were some Protestant churches involved, like my former church, the United Church of Canada. And similarly in the U.S., there is actually a native lawyer in Washington called Ken Bearchief, who has been bringing charges against the Jesuits for their Indian boarding schools in Washington and in North and South Dakota. And he's actually at the point now where the Jesuits have agreed to a settlement. And what's interesting is the stories that I hear from the people Ken Bearchief works with are identical to what you hear in Canada. As a matter of fact, I was with a survivor of the Jesuit school in Omak, Washington, who described that she actually saw children being buried by some of the priests, children who had died in these schools. So I would say that even though it's still just beginning to come out in the U.S., you're going to find exactly the same atrocities that went on there. And it's, by and large, the Catholic and some of the major Protestant churches responsible.
Well, see, in my family, the history is somewhat different because around 1900, my various sets of great-grandparents chose to drop off the rolls. If you weren't on the rolls, your children weren't taken. Was that true in Canada?
No, the difference is, one big difference is in the U.S., in 1924, Native people were allowed the right to become citizens. That's never been the case in Canada. Under the Indian Act, if you live on a reservation, you're considered still a legal ward of the state in perpetuity. That means until the end of time, Native people are not, they're put in the same category legally as a child or a mentally incompetent person in that the state runs their affairs. So under the Indian Act, that means that Indians are not citizens like everybody else. And that's a big difference because it means they don't have any recourse like you would in the U.S. As a U.S. citizen, you could sue and, petition the government and all that stuff. You can't do that as an Indian in Canada except through the indulgence of the crown, as they say. So it's a very different situation.
Well, what about the status of the people that you work with? If they're not affiliated with the nation, they're clearly indigenous, but they've lost connection to the nations and enrollment, what are their status as citizens?
Well, legally, that's kind of a catch-22 because while they're not on a reservation and so could be considered to be not a ward of the state, they're in such a terrible state they don't have anybody to go to bat for them. I mean, most of these people I work with are homeless. Their own chiefs ignore them. As a matter of fact, a lot of the people in downtown Vancouver are refugees from their own territory in northern British Columbia. After being forced off their land because of the violence on the reservation or whatever, they drift down, a kind of a common third world pattern. A lot of landless indigenous people are living on the streets of Vancouver. So, literally there's no organization that represents them, and they're fair game. I mean, most of the women who've disappeared on the streets of Vancouver are Aboriginal, and, even though they're only 2% of the population, half the prison population in the West are Native people. So, I mean, it's most Native people are living in that under conditions of war, and but that's not acknowledged, you know, within the wider society.
Okay, now I have a couple of questions coming in from Mike in California. It's Kevin, good to have you on the show. I'm simply amazed at your courage and perseverance. Can you detail some harassment being brought upon you by the police, government, and churches, as well as upon local Natives to stop the investigation of the Holocaust?
Well, to answer your first the last part first, there's a recent example of what happens to Native people who go to bat, try to go to bat for the survivors, and who work with me. There, just over a year ago, there was a Native man, Bingo Dawson, Johnny Bingo Dawson, who was a Native man in Vancouver, a residential school survivor, and he was beaten to death by three Vancouver police, and there was an eyewitness to that. The coroner's report says he died of alcohol poisoning, even though the toxicology report said that there was no alcohol in his bloodstream. But an eyewitness, Rick Lavely, saw the policeman beating him so badly that he died 2 days later. Rick Lavely last week was threatened by the Vancouver police that if he ever told that story, he'd be arrested. And we have that on video. I'm actually posting it on YouTube this week. So Native people who speak out are targeted in that way. And what they do with me, since I'm not Native, and I think, frankly, if I was Native, I would have been dead a long time ago. But being a white guy, a former minister, they can't do that to me. All they can do is discredit and harass and attack the people around me. So I faced everything from threats of lawsuits, physical attack, the usual kind of smear and misinformation campaign, the loss of my family, the disruption of jobs, all of that, kind of the whole gamut short of killing me. And it's designed to discredit so that people won't listen, and that's an ongoing thing. And I think in effect it's a sign of how effective we've been in this work that they have to feel that they have to continue that type of harassment.
Okay, now I believe I have a guest calling in on the line from the engineer. Do I have a caller on the line?
Yes, you do. This is Samantha from New York. We were very worried about you when you didn't show up after already hearing that you had been beaten up. I'm very glad to know that you're okay. I'd like actually to know in detail the various means used for murder of the natives, why they were killed, why and how it was covered up for so long.
Okay. You know, what accounts for, from what I've researched, what accounts for the enormous death rate was that in the first half of the 20th century especially, but it continued on after, but especially in the first, from 1900 to 1950, there was a concerted plan to take Native kids, put them in these residential schools, and then kill off a lot of them using germ warfare. In effect, taking children who were healthy and housing them in the same dormitory as kids who were dying of smallpox and tuberculosis. And we've had reports from Indian agents and doctors, describing that practice of housing the healthy with the sick. And they did that consistently over decades. It's what accounted for the enormous mortality rate. And that's now being admitted by the government that that practice was going on. So it was to get Native people off the land, get the resources. It was to create a controlled population. At a time in Canada when, white settlers were moving in there quickly and they needed to get the natives off the land and, in a very rapid way. And that's in effect what happened. Some of the other things that were going on is that there was a plan to, make large areas of the native population infertile. So there were actually sterilization clinics set up all over the West Coast run by the Catholic and the United Churches. And their medical missionary doctors that were bringing in thousands of Native people and just sterilizing them en masse. And that's been proven. We have the documentation and the eyewitnesses for all that. So all of those things are defined as genocide under the UN Convention as such. And, the proof is all there.
Okay.
Rather ironic that the Catholic Church was sponsoring sterilization.
Go ahead. Jenna.
Oh, go ahead, Samantha.
What I was wondering is, how has the Catholic Church been able to get away with covering something up like this, like they did with all the, another crime? I mean, aren't they being watched even more closely after the crimes they've already committed against, with all the sex crimes and the molestations?
Well, that's the question. How can they get away with it? And don't forget that under they operate under canon law, which governments recognize as a separate legal system. So in effect, the churches are outside the law. And I had proof of that when I was being thrown out of the United Church. I took my case to numerous lawyers, Civil Liberties Association, and they all said the same thing. I even got a letter from the Attorney General in British Columbia that said what the church's internal disciplinary matters are outside the jurisdiction of this department. In other words, he was saying that the laws of Canada don't apply to the churches within their own courts. So in other words, the church employees can break the law. Now, occasionally there's a priest who's, you know, thrown to the wolves, so to speak. They make a show trial of the fact that this priest is being tried for raping children. But by and large, more than 90% of the people who do these crimes in the church get away with them. And that's been a long historical reality, you know, for centuries, that the church operates according to its own laws. Now, that needs to be challenged, obviously. And, you know, now that this is all coming out, I think it's harder and harder for the church to avoid facing the music on this stuff.
Okay, thank you for answering my questions. I'm sorry I took so much of your time. I am so grateful that you're
fine.
Here and you're doing what you're doing. Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Has it been your experience since the revelations about the Catholic Church regarding the pedophilia, the abuses by the priests of populations around the world, not just indigenous populations, but in, like you said, in Ireland, in UK, it's come out in Belgium. Around the world, is this going to facilitate your ability to bring attention to these matters as far as the indigenous people? Or is it likely to divert attention?
Very much it helps facilitate our whole movement. I mean, for years I was operating in the wilderness and there was no media interest or anything coming down. But in the last 2 to 3 years, I've been to Europe several times, and every time I go there, national TV and radio in all of these countries are covering what we're doing. For the first time, you know, you have our film Unrepentant was actually broadcast in Europe to over 10 million people by the German and Swiss TV networks. And there's enormous interest in this stuff because they know that it applies very much to them. You know, the Catholic Church has had a long history of doing this all over the world. And frankly, the same things that happen to Native people here in North America were started in Europe. I mean, so many of our own ancestors were forced off the land. They weren't allowed to practice their traditional way of life or their languages. The same process happened there. So, in effect, we're looking at a huge historical crime. And finally, there's some... these churches and governments are being forced to look and admit their own actions. So I would say now I definitely see a groundswell. I mean, last September I was in London, England, and when the Pope came to visit, there was over 20,000 people in the streets protesting his visit and the fact that the government was paying £10 million to bring the guy there. So I would say there's an enormous groundswell of people all over the world who want to see the, you know, justice brought to bear, and I'm really confident that it's going to happen.
Okay, now I have a question from William in New Jersey. Is the church and government still involved in genocide against the nations? Are these practices still going on, or is this a thing of the past and they're looking for redress for past crimes?
No, it's not a thing of the past. If you look at the death rate in the Aboriginal world, it's still as high as ever, and one of the reasons is Native people are continuing to lose their land and their culture and their language at an ever-increasing rate. To give you an example of how it's continuing, not only are Native people killed with impunity regularly across the country by police, but in areas like the prairies in northern Saskatchewan, you have a uranium mining going on, which is causing devastation, just like in the Black Hills in South Dakota. The same company, actually, it's called Camco. It's the largest uranium company in North America. It provides the American military with a lot of their depleted uranium. Well, Camco is devastating large areas of northern Saskatchewan by dumping their uranium tailings on Native reservations. Like in Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, the radiation levels in the water are 500 times the safety levels, and you have enormous numbers of Native people dying off from that. Well, you know, we consider that the same kind of genocide going on, that kind of environmental racism, where, you know, look at where most of the toxic waste dumps are located across North America. It's always near communities of minorities, indigenous people, blacks, Hispanics. That's the kind of thing we're talking about. There's also the continual loss of land. Like I said before, most Native people have been forced off their land, and as a result, they're dying at a very high rate. So all of that indicates that genocide is just changed its form, but it's certainly continuing.
Okay, now I have, this isn't a question, but from John in the Canadian Rockies, a message of encouragement. He sends this quote to remind you that first they ignore you, then they ridicule you, then they fight you, then you win. That would be Mahatma Gandhi. There I have people in the audience offering support. I also was in a conversation earlier with a number of Canadians who have commented on the fact that you are fairly controversial within Canada.
That's a word in Canada that is supposed to condemn someone instantly. They just it's a pejorative term, controversial. And I, you know, in response, I would say I think it's a quote I heard from John F. Kennedy once, where he said, "The Athenian lawmaker Solon decreed a crime for any citizen to shrink from controversy." And in this case, you know, it's a label I wear proudly, because when people in Canada say he's controversial, it means that various people have come along over the years and said, well, for example, one of the accusations put against me is that I'm exploiting Native people and using their stories without their permission. Well, if you trace that rumor, it goes back to the summer of 1998 when we held our first tribunal in Vancouver. And at that tribunal, where we began to name that there were various Native chiefs, government chiefs, who, according to their own people, were involved in some of these criminal activities, involving the child trafficking with on reservations and that kind of thing. Right after we began to air that evidence, these rumors began, and it was circulating from within these circles of government-funded chiefs. And what it was designed to do, you see, the way it operates now, the Canadian government doesn't do the dirty work anymore. They get their hired help to do it. And in this case, what it's designed to do is to alienate people so that they don't bring out their stories. Because unfortunately, and I wish it wasn't the case, but over the last 15 years, myself and the people I work with have been the only force in Canada to challenge that and to bring out these stories. And so in response, you know, you've got to expect these kind of smear campaigns. I'm not surprised in that sense. But what I do say to people is the issue isn't me at all. The issue is the evidence. And if people want to address the evidence, and it's significant that never in the last almost 20 years have I ever been brought to court by the church or the government. They've never brought forward counter evidence. They've never tried to stop me. And if I was libeling people, that would have happened. So I think all of the proof is in the pudding, and I'm quite willing to talk to anybody about the concerns they have. But like I say, let's base it on evidence and not innuendo and hearsay.
Oh, in fact, I'm glad you made that comment, because that specifically was mentioned in the course of the earlier discussion, that if your actions were slandering individuals, why have you not, or have you been taken to court for libel or slander? Or
no.
You've never been taken to court?
No. Since I was fired by the United Church in 1995, and I've continually aired everything that happened to me, it's in both of my books. As a matter of fact, there's a new book out now you can get through Amazon.com, which is Unrepentant, Disrobing the Emperor, and it tells this entire story. I've been bringing that out for over 15 years now, and I've never been brought to court by either the United Church, the government, anybody over these things.
Okay, well, let me touch on a couple of other allegations that were made during the course of this discussion. One is, I was told by my engineer that this phone number we called you are in Canada.
Yes.
Okay, because one of the allegations is that you left Canada to avoid legal action against yourself and are living in the United States. Is there any truth to that?
That's a new one. My dad lives in Florida, and I sometimes visit down there. But no, I'm living in Nanaimo, British Columbia, which is on Vancouver Island. And I often work in Vancouver.
Okay.
I hadn't heard
another one that was brought up, and in fact, They gave me a link to the document, the transcript from the hearings when you, as you said, were fired by the United Church. And one of the things was a request by the church for you to have a mental health evaluation.
No, actually, they dropped that. But you know what? That whole thing is really interesting because when I was fired, and they subsequently admitted that their lawyer in John Jessamine, who actually was also the head of the panel that delisted me, he admitted that the demand for a psychiatric evaluation was simply something they needed to do in order to remove me unilaterally from my pulpit after I wrote a letter exposing how they were speculating in stolen native land. And they dropped that demand for a psychiatric evaluation. And in fact, I said, okay, well, where's the evidence that I need one? And they never provided that evidence. But when the media began snooping around, they once again resurrect this demand that, oh, yeah, the guy was crazy, or we thought he was crazy. I mean, it's easy to say that about somebody, but they've never provided any proof. They've never, you know, given a shred of evidence to support that allegation. So, in fact, the church dropped that. But when the media start raising an interest again, they keep resurrecting that in order to basically try to discredit me. So, I mean, you know, it's part of the thing you can expect. And what I often say to church people who raise that, and they don't really do that anymore, you know, it's been years since they've tried that one. But, you know, what I say is, look, is it crazy to simply want to hold your church accountable to answer, you know, these hard questions about why did you follow a policy that resulted in the deaths of thousands of children? I mean, it isn't crazy to be asking those questions. And I think that it's time for the church to stop this charade of trying to blacken my name and really address the issue.
Now, we had covered this a little bit earlier, but we have some new guests tuning in. And I want to reiterate which populations of natives that you work with. Are you formally affiliated with any of the tribes, or you work solely with those who live off reservation?
No, we've had, for example, back east on Ganawake Reserve, which is one of the Mohawk reserves. I work with the clan mothers there. In Brantford, Ontario, I've been invited in March to come and speak to a group of clan mothers on the Six Nations Reserve near Brantford, Ontario. So the tribal groups I tend to work with are traditionalists. They're clan mothers, they're traditional elders. They're not the government-funded native chiefs, because on every reservation in Canada, and probably the same in the States, there's really two systems of power. There's a traditional hereditary leadership, and then there's the government, the elected government-funded leaders, which were imposed under the Indian Act. You know, so which native group you're talking to will give a very different take on not only me, but all this whole issue. And I think that's, you know, the thing to keep in mind here.
Yes, because that was one of the other points that was brought up, is that many of the native nations agreed to the settlement. They felt that they have stated, these leaders have stated, that they have felt this was what was best for their people. So obviously...
Some of the groups have supported it. There's not unanimity about this in the native world any more than there would be in the white world or any other culture. There's a real difference of opinion about whether people should take the money, whether they should settle with the government. For example, in British Columbia, there were never any treaties signed out here, by and large. And so a lot of the native groups say, we're not sitting down and having treaty discussions because we've never relinquished our land. That's different in other parts of the country. So it's kind of like... It's a colonial idea, the notion of native people as a homogenous group. There's many different nations, many different opinions about this, and I'm not claiming to represent any of them. What I'm trying to do by my work is to address my own culture and say we have to take responsibility and look at our dark history here.
Okay. Now, my producer has informed me, after the papers or the tribunal in March, if they send investigators to Canada, we would like to have you come back to update us at that time.
This has
brought up a lot of controversy because, again, I spoke to a group of Canadians earlier, because being in the U.S., I hadn't heard a lot about your work, although I was familiar with the residential schools. I have a number of friends among the Native Americans, especially among the Iroquois Mohawk, they can cross the borders. Mm-hmm. So then What is the next phase?
Well, like I said, you know, this has really become more than Canada or the U.S. It's really an international issue. And what we're hoping to do out of this tribunal is start a process where, frankly, the Canadian government and its churches can be brought to trial in a war crimes tribunal, because that's right up till now, what are crimes against humanity have been defined as tort offenses under the law of physical and sexual abuse. And unfortunately, some native chiefs have gone along with this, really, the charade whereby we're pretending that children weren't killed. We're pretending that sterilizations and mass murder didn't go on. That this is something that can be resolved with a little bit of money and an apology. And, of course, it can't be. So what we're hoping is to take this to a higher level of justice and accountability. And that process has already begun. What's going to hold it back is when people think that playing along with these institutions that committed the crime is somehow going to get them an answer. And, you know, we've seen in practice that that isn't the case.
So let me see if I can summarize this just a little bit. So what we're really looking at here, a very center core issue that I'm picking up on, is that in secular societies, allowing the church to operate, any church, whether it be the Catholic Church or the United Church or the Lutheran Church or the Anglican Church or any other religious organization, to operate outside the laws of the society is something that we need to address as secular nations. If we truly believe in secularism, how are these churches allowed to commit crimes and not be held accountable by the society they're committing the crimes against?
Absolutely. I think that that's hitting it right on the head. It's part of this bigger issue. And for example, we have to look at structural changes so that churches that are committing these crimes are not granted tax exemption under the law, that priests and ministers should be licensed as public servants, so then when they abuse a child, their license can be taken away. They should not be tried in their own courts. The churches should not be above the law in that way. And, you know, and there's, if you look at the polls in Canada, there was a poll recently about the taxation of churches, and over 50% of Canadians supported taxing the churches for their property in that, since very few of them are actually operating as charitable societies in terms of feeding the poor and that. So we have to really look again at our whole legal system and how it does allow, you know, these churches are, when they can operate in this way, they're magnets for every pedophile and child abuser on the planet, because they know that you can become a priest and literally get away with raping and even killing children and never be held accountable.
Okay. Well, now we're coming close to the end of our time. We've covered a lot of ground. Is there anything that you want to get out before the people, to the listeners, that we haven't covered or that you'd like to summarize with?
I'd like to let people realize that this is an issue for all of us because of the issue you just said, which is that powerful and unaccountable bodies in our midst that are self-regulating, like churches, are a danger, a clear and present danger to people and our children. And under the policy that's still in place in the Vatican, Crimen Solicitanus, it's called, a policy that the present Pope Joseph Ratzinger helped to write, it says that when priests and bishops know about the abuse of a child in a Catholic parish, they are to hide that crime. They're not to tell the police, and they're to try to convince the victim to sign a statement that it never happened. That's a crime of obstruction of justice, and every priest in the world is ordered to do that under a policy still in place in the Catholic Church. So people have to protect themselves from that, protect their children. And one of the ways that we urge people to do that is simply to get the story out and to work with us. I wanted to remind people again, our website is itccs.org, and my website is hiddennolonger.com, and you can read a lot of the evidence that I've been talking about there. And I, again, want to thank you for having me on the air, and I hope we can do it again.
Okay, so your website, your personal website is Hidden No More. That's where your research and evidence is located.
HiddenNoLonger.com.
HiddenNoLonger.com.
And hidden, yes, and ITCCS.org is the website.
And that's for the International Tribunal.
Yes, thank you.
And then you're, okay, I want to make sure that the audience had that clear right at the end. There was something else that somebody distracted me. I'm sorry. Okay, so with all of this and with the accomplishments you've made, now, somebody pointed out, though, this, while the Catholic Church is the predominant villain here, the most visible villain, they're not the only church involved in this.
No, there was a lot of the Protestant churches were the United Church, the Church of England, or the Anglican Church, and you'll find it similarly in the U.S., the same kind of pattern of large-scale involvement of these churches.
Okay, and one last question, very briefly. What can my listeners who are paying attention tonight, what can they be doing? Can they be writing their government? Can they...
Yes, you can definitely, if you're in the United States, write to Obama and ask him to support our investigation to bring charges against the Canadian government and his churches for crimes against humanity. And they can also download all of the evidence I've been talking about from our website, hiddennolonger.com. You can read all of that. And at the end of that book, there's a list of things, suggestions you can do to help our work.
Oh, so you do have it laid out so that there's active, you know, if people want to become activists in this issue. So you've been laying the groundwork for 20 years. How has
this
impacted your family and your children?
Well, my daughters are grown up now. They're both in university, and they're amazed because there was a lot I never told them because of a lot of the trouble I was going through. And now that they're learning about this, I mean, they, like a lot of people in their generation, are quite outraged and want some answers. I should mention to the American listeners, too, I will be coming through the U.S. on a speaking tour after Europe and Canada. And if you want to get a hold of me, my email is hiddenfromhistory@yahoo.ca. And I'd be happy to come and speak in your communities about all of this stuff. Because, like I say, it's an issue beginning in the United States now, too, with lawsuits against churches on behalf of Native people.
Okay. And I had one other person, and you may not be able to provide any names, but she's affiliated with the Kanawake Reservation. And she was wondering which of the clan mothers you were in touch with.
I'm working with, I'm not sure if I'm at liberty to say over the phone because they are a bit concerned, but I would be willing to share that name with the person if they contact me offline. I don't want to say over the air at this point, but
okay,
I can tell you that one of the people is Ganta Nato Horn, who has been on my radio program, but at this point I don't want to say the other names until I check with them. But again, if you'd like to contact me at hiddenfromhistory@yahoo.ca, I'd be willing to talk to her about that.
Okay, well, Kevin, I want to thank you so much for being here with us tonight. Our time is up. We will post your website and your information on the People Speak site so people can follow up on this and be as active as they choose to be. Please join us next week with Basima Farhat on her return to the People Speak with her guest Don Latin, author of the Harvard Psychedelic Club and other books. Next week on the People Speak radio show on BBS Radio, 8:55 to 9:55 Eastern Standard Time.